The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. I'm Glenn Schrum, a designer with Zieger Sneed in Baltimore, and I'm pleased to introduce Daniel Libeskind. Before we get started, I'd like to ask everyone to turn off your cell phones and please refrain from any photography during the talk. Born in Poland in 1946, Daniel Libeskind is the son of Holocaust survivors who had been imprisoned in Soviet labor camps. His family would flee to Israel before moving to New York in 1960. An accomplished musician by the age of 12, Libeskind followed his passion for visual art to the field of architecture. His career as an educator and theorist began with an architecture degree from Cooper Union. Libeskind's academic resume includes serving as the Paul Philippe Cray Professor at University of Pennsylvania, being the first to be awarded the Louis Kahn Visiting Professorship at Yale, and founding his own school of architecture called Architecture Intermundium in 1985. The name of his architecture program, Intermundium, meaning between two worlds, illustrates his belief that true architecture education lies between practice and academia. This concept of being between two seemingly opposing forces can serve as a framework to analyze Libeskind's work. Between form and space, light and darkness, transparency and opacity, spiritual and tangible, history and future, these are all issues addressed in his designs. Libeskind's work has been debated from the start. In fact, it would seem that his work has never been anything but controversial, as he chooses to work within the spiritual realm. Libeskind's proposal for the Twin Tower Memorial is no exception. It is both spiritually significant and controversial. In his new book, Breaking Ground, Libeskind traces his life in architecture through his numerous projects and commissions. The book is an invitation to see the world through his eyes and through the lens of architecture. Tonight, Mr. Libeskind will be interviewed by Philadelphia Inquirer's Pulitzer-nominated critic, Inga Saffron. Please join me in welcoming Inga Saffron and Daniel Libeskind.
Good evening. Thank you for being here with Daniel Libeskind. You've heard that introduction, and this is a special opportunity to talk about one of the most important building sites in the country right now, maybe in the world, and about Daniel Libeskind's role in that. So I'm going to ask a few questions, and we can take it from there. So when you were selected on February 27th, 2003, as the designer for Ground Zero, after a competition that drew worldwide interest, you were held up as a visionary and a great artist and poet who would extract meaning from the tragedy of 9/11. Today, you're not the lead designer for any of the important buildings on the site. What went wrong?
Nothing. It's interesting, but first of all, let me say I'm delighted that you're here, and I love being in Philadelphia because I used to teach here at the University of Pennsylvania some years ago. Building a city, rebuilding Ground Zero and doing something significant is not about a job. It's not about getting a building here and there. It's not about only some aesthetic issues, you know, what do we like, what do we don't like. It is how to bring the memory of that day, 9/11, what it meant to the world, what it meant to New Yorkers, what it meant to those who perished, their families, to the world. And how does New York acknowledge this very special site and move ahead in a way that is proper to a kind of capital of the free world? That's why it was attacked. I never considered my role some little role of, you know, negotiating about buildings. It's about how to create a plan that is sustainable, that can be developed, that can evolve, that is open and flexible to developments and yet has a backbone which can deliver the kind of spirit which the public of New York selected and the governor and others. And I stick by that role. It is my role. You know, architecture critics, others write all sorts of gossip. But let me tell you to this audience that the plan is intact. The plan is developing, of course. It has to develop. Great architects and investors and others are, you know, making the site into reality. But what the public has seen is going to be delivered, which means the memorial at the center of the site, the slurry wall, the footprints, the Freedom Tower, the cultural buildings at the center, and a completely new neighborhood in Lower Manhattan. And, you know, it's not about just playing solo. I just want to say building a city is kind of like a symphony. And it's not about, you know, if you write the score, you have to be able to have others interpret it. You have to be a believer in democracy, by the way. So many people long for strong hands to say, okay, now it's a tabula rasa, now, Mr. Architect, go and do it. And I don't believe in it. I believe in the forces of democracy. It's not just a word. It means struggling. And it's not always easy. And those of you who have followed the process know that it's been a struggle, and you don't always win all the things that you think or hope for, but it's meaningful, and I believe in it.
Having established the original vision for the site, how are you involved now in coordinating the other architects, such as Calatrava, Gary, Michael Arad, and others, in carrying out your vision for the site?
Well, in my book, Breaking Ground, I do speak about the collaborative notion, and of course not all collaborations are easy, but it is, I'm entrusted by the Port Authority, by the Lower Manhattan Development Corporation, by the governor, the mayor, and the authorities to make sure that this is not just a bunch of buildings standing together, that it is a composition. And I want to say something. Many people who have looked at the development of these plans, the seven finals particularly, were saying, you know, I like this one better than this one, I like this one better than this one. But in fact, there was two things which distinguished my plan fundamentally from all others, which was not really talked about. Number one is there was not a megastructure to be done by a single architect. It was quite on the contrary. How to create an evolutionary plan that can be achieved in time by different people, collaborating across the way an organic growth of a city happens. It doesn't happen by a decision, by a few you know, yeses or noes. That was number one. And number two, what was very different about my scheme, was that it was a creation of a neighborhood. It was not about just a single buildings, but how do you coordinate? And again, so I'm involved. Of course, I'm involved with those who own the land. The Port Authority is in charge. I'm involved with the different stakeholders, which, by the way, include at the center families of the victims, the local community, people who work in the area. And finally, I always have considered that my client is not just the big stakeholders, but it's every child, every family, everyone who cares about what happened on that site, and everybody who is part of the future of that site. And that's almost everybody in the free world.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's extremely important. You were born in Poland right after World War II and moved to the U.S. when you were just about 13 and grew up as a Jewish immigrant in New York. You attended the two great public institutions there, Bronx High School of Science and Cooper Union. How did those experiences inform your vision for rebuilding Ground Zero, for memorializing the tragedy of 9/11?
It really shaped me as a human being. I mean, arriving, you know, I was probably one of the last immigrants to arrive to New York by boat. Because later on, it became cheaper to fly. And most, you know, the boats stopped. And I came to the New York Harbor, just like in the movies, really, in August 1959 on a ship called SS Constitution, by the way. And we arrived, you know, and I tell the story in the book. My mother woke us up early, my sister and I, and we were stood on the deck at 5 o'clock in the morning, looking at the Statue of Liberty and the skyline of Lower Manhattan. And to us who were immigrants, who came, you know, we lived under communist dictatorship, we saw in that skyline and in that Statue of Liberty not symbols or sort of metaphors. These were realities. These were liberties that we dreamt about. These were the opportunities that we never had. This was what the world of freedom really was. And that shaped my view of Ground Zero as well. When I went down to Bedrock at Ground Zero, I thought that this site is not just going to be about rebuilding 10 million square feet of density, 6 million square feet of infrastructure, memorial, and all these things. It has to somehow speak to an experience that I think is so profoundly there in New York, and we often forget that that was the capital, that that's where George Washington, where he was inaugurated. And by the way, when I created the Wedge of Light Plaza, I thought, how do you put the Freedom Tower, the tallest building in the world, next to the smallest church, but so profound? That's where the founders of this country came to pray after the inauguration. And that informed my view of the site. It also informed my belief that architecture is not about prima donnas and signature architects, and it's about people. And, you know, my parents were hardworking people, immigrants, like most of this country. And I appreciate that architecture is not just about consumer items. It's about a memory. It's about culture. It's about the social spaces that we are lucky to have in this country.
Mm-hmm. In your book and in various at various press conferences along the way as this project's evolved, I've always been struck by sort of this mix of this intensely patriotic narrative and this architectural sophistication. It's a very unusual combination. It really comes across in your book. I call it sort of Schmaltz and theory together. And it's very clear that in the early part of the design process that Governor Pataki, the New York's governor, was very attracted by this narrative that you just described. The way you compare the foundations, the bathtub, to the American Constitution, and the way this metaphor of it, of the bathtub withstanding the attack, just as American democracy withstood the attack. And given the way that so many other architects are now prominent in this project, do you feel that your language and vision have been co-opted by others, that they've taken your narrative and use it for their architecture?
No, let me first of all say, that's an interesting question. But, you know, patriotism is not schmaltz. You know, to love, no, really. Too many people consider, you know, the Declaration of Independence, the fact that the Tower is 1776, oh, it's a cute idea. But it's not about cuteness. It's not about sentimentality, nostalgia. It's really about the roots of what a place is about. And perhaps as an immigrant who came to this country, I am more aware of it, as were my parents, mm-hmm. who were Holocaust survivors. So, no, it's not schmaltz in theory. It's what architecture has always been when it is authentic, when it is rooted in a belief that a place is more than just the materials from which it is constructed. But I do believe that the development of Ground Zero and all the famous architects who are participating is following this plan. And this plan, of course, is like a score. When you write a piece of music, a symphony, you can't play the fiddle and the drums, and you have to allow the score to be interpreted, to be given vitality, and to be shaped by everyone. And I think that is really not a metaphor. The slurry wall, by the way, is not a metaphor. It is a wall that both is a trace of the attack of 9/11. That's what was revealed. It was never supposed to be revealed. But it is also, as I described it, I went down and I touched it, something extraordinary, because it's not just a wall. It's a dam, the whole ocean, you feel it. And as we're speaking here, you know, the engineers from Port Authority are measuring, you know, millimeter shifts in that wall, because it is living. It's not like dead foundations in Rome or Greece. And I wanted that experience to be accessible to people, because it's not about metaphors. It's about realities.
Maybe you should describe that bathtub and how it functioned and what your plan was for it.
Well, first of all, in my plan, at the center is the memorial. It was not about buildings. It was about that place as a recognition of those who fell there. And we often forget there was people from more than 90 foreign countries also. It was not just, it was the world, and that's what it was about. So that wall, and I described it as going down some 70 feet. It was a rainy day. I asked the Port Authority if I could go down, and they said, you know, why would you want to go down? You can see exactly, you know, no other architects apparently even asked to go down, because you could see it. But I felt like a diver going into an ocean. You know, when you go down there and descend progressively, you feel the atmosphere, the pressure on your head. You get close to something almost indescribable, because who has ever stood at a bedrock? You know, maybe a few workers, and then it's covered up immediately by buildings. But to stand in that bedrock and to look up at the small figures of people up on the streets of New York, and to see the light of New York, to feel the power of the catastrophe, but also the resilience of what New York really is about. And it could never have been done without the belief in such a city. Mm-hmm. And we often forget the cities are spiritual. They're not just agglomerations of density or cars. They're about desire, they're about fulfillment, about dreams that come true. So I from the very beginning thought this is an orienting part of the site, and that's of course at the center of the site, and then of course the spiraling buildings which distribute this huge density rising to the Freedom Tower in a kind of dynamic of the torch on the Statue of Liberty, and of course a neighborhood with plazas, cultural buildings at the center, transportation, and streets that are vital and speak to the future.
Mm-hmm. This wall also held back the Hudson River.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. This is a huge wall. It's very difficult to construct. And in all my years of being an architect, I never heard an engineer mention this, the word. I never heard this word, slurry wall. It's a very special technique of constructing a wall in that kind of vulnerable situation. But it's a wall that, had it collapsed, let me just put it this way. That's what the engineers of the Port Authority told me. As I said, what is it really doing? They said, if this wall collapses, all of New York, underground, the entire subway system would have been flooded. It would have been a true apocalypse. It would have been the kind of... But it held back. And for whatever reasons, I felt that this wall was very eloquent had eloquence to it. It spoke. It was kind of a text that spoke about things that are cannot really be written down and are interesting.
Mm-hmm. Many people say that New York's Governor Pataki should have acted more forcefully to remove the control of Ground Zero from Larry Silverstein, a commercial developer who acquired the rights to the site mere weeks before the tragedy, that he should have done this to give the redevelopment a more civic-minded focus. Why do you think that Governor Pataki didn't take that step?
It's an interesting question. I think it's difficult. It's in the middle of New York. It's low. We often forget that the three largest business centers in the United States, the three biggest concentration of business, the first one is Midtown Manhattan, the second one is Chicago Loop, and the third one is Lower Manhattan. So Lower Manhattan itself constitutes one of the greatest business centers in the world. Now, after the attacks of 9/11, it was possible, theoretically, to turn the site into something else. But at the same time, it's part of the pulse of New York. And it's actually something very moving that the economy of New York, the fact that no one had a competition to restore, Port Authority connections on the PATH trains from New Jersey. There was no competition. It was kind of lifeblood of the viability of New York. And I think the governor probably thought, this is New York. This is not going to become something else. And for whatever reasons, I can't read his mind, but the site remained complex, divided into many different dimensions, and not easy to deal with, mm-hmm. but for anyone,
yeah.
not even for the governor.
Are you still on speaking terms with Larry Silverstein?
Well, I have a professional relationship with everyone I collaborate with, and I describe in the book, it's one thing to have a vision for something, but how do you go from the vision to reality? How do you translate it? Now, if you're just a dreamer, then you would just leave it at nice drawings, good exhibitions, good reports for critics, a good review in the New York Times. But if you believe in it, if you're a true visionary, then you have to be practical. You have to know that, you have to make the necessary compromises to achieve things. And by the way, I'm often criticized by many people for compromise. And I thought, how ironic. Because in everyday life, compromise is a good thing. We live in a world... The world is basically made on compromises. We are not alone here in history and in space. And it's a good word in public relations, in political, in between families. And I think it belongs in architecture. I think architecture is not an authoritarian art. I describe this in the book. It should not be conceived just as kind of a stamp of power. It should be partly the art of compromise. But the only thing that can be compromised is something that has an idea. That has something at the core of it. If you have no idea, you cannot compromise because there's no such meaning to the word. So, of course, I had to make the necessary compromises in order for the project to move ahead. And I guess that's also part of the investors, Larry Silverstein, the other architects, the authorities, the retail people, all the parties that are part to this plan.
Well, since we're speaking of compromises, I guess we should turn to David Child, the architect from Skidmore, Owings & Merrill. And we should talk about your collaboration on Freedom Tower, which was the tallest tower that you planned for the site, 1,776 feet high, and with some stylized resemblance to the Statue of Liberty in the way that it torqued. The design that was unveiled is different from the one you originally conceived. It's all office space. The gardens that you envisioned for the upper floors are gone. The raised arm holding the torch, or the stylized torch, is much shorter than you originally wanted. Do you consider it your design?
Well, there are several things about a tower that are very important. Number one, where the tower stands, where the Freedom Tower would stand. It wasn't easy to keep it at the apogee of that spiral of, you know, because the investors and others wanted to move it somewhere else. We don't need it here. We want it there. I wanted it to be related to the Hudson River. I wanted it to be where it belongs in the plan. And that was not an easy battle to win. And I was happy that was the decision. Second part was that I was involved in the conceptual design and schematic design of this tower because this is not a normal tower. This is not a tower of 150 stories high. It's a very special tower. It has about 65 stories of office spaces, which means it's a much less vulnerable tower. Classical, doesn't have the sky lobbies, doesn't have the mechanism that we saw fail so tragically at the World Trade Center. So it can be made into something that is also leasable and realizable. Then I had 5 stories of public programming, which is still intact, absolutely. But I wanted to raise the tower to its full height, to 70, 76. How do you do it? Well, I did it in a very practical way. Not a dreamlike way, but you know what can produce revenue? And it is the antennas that were lost on the World Trade Center, can produce the revenue that reaches the full 1776 feet. Therefore, it is being built. Now, I had the gardens as a connection between that asymmetrical arm of the Statue of Liberty and the roof. And the SOM has the windmills, which is also, I think, an acceptable interpretation of the fact that life is victorious in the sky. So again, it was a hard-won battle. It was not easy. This collaboration was a very painful one, very, very difficult one. But then, you know, nobody expects it to be easy anyway. It was nothing that I could have foreseen, but it was tremendous. But at the end, I was proud to stand with architects, with the governor, with all the different parties at that press conference which unveiled the Freedom Tower, because I think it will be an inspiring tower. It will be beautiful. And I think it will, when all is said and done, all these small questions will disappear and we will see something rising on that site, which is the proper thing.
What were the ideas that you defended to the last on that project? That you were in battle with David Childs over, but in Sicily.
There were many battles, but I defended the fact that this is a special tower. First of all, that it has to be a tower that is not just. By the way, the 6 other proposals, if you want to go back, proposed 150-story towers, even by very famous architects like Lord Norman Foster. Now think about it. It's not possible. There is no such investment. There is no such reality. There is no such capacity. So again, architecture is the art not only of the ideal, but what is possible to make. And I'm proud that this tower is being built because it's not just a fantasy. It is a tower that, you know, aesthetically might have been altered here and there, and of course it has. It has gone through many iterations and through many different interests and through many, and you don't win everything. I lost a major thing in the tower because the footprint got so big of the tower. I couldn't get it smaller. I fought that battle, but I lost it. And therefore, the Park of Heroes, which was dedicated to the police forces, fire, you know, the heroes really of that day, disappeared. It was one of the things that I couldn't keep. But of course, the Wedge of Light I fought for, and I want to just say something about it. There was never a demand. You know, the architects in this competition had to follow a program. The architects don't create the program about streets, about public space. You know, they get it from the authorities, from the Port Authority, from investors and so on. There was no call for a public space at Ground Zero. There was a call only for the memorial. But I thought, this is Lower Manhattan. It's going to have millions of people come to this site. It's not about dark and dingy streets of what we saw in the rest of this dark canyon-like world. We have to have a place for the public to celebrate also New York. So I proposed the Wedge of Light, which was determined by the 2 angles, 8:46 a.m. when the first tower was struck and 10:28 when the second tower collapsed, defining in light that public space. And I have to say that this there would never have been a public space because there was no call. There was call for more buildings and more density for office buildings. And I'm very proud that the station of Calatrava is also oriented exactly as I proposed, which is towards Fulton Street, because Fulton is the great street that brings the public east-west between Hudson and East River. I think it's going to be a very beautiful experience to experience New York as a Lower Manhattan, as a place that you can walk and is interesting and is not cut by huge buildings that disconnect the public.
Both Larry Silverstein and the Port Authority have been insistent that the amount of office space, or nearly the amount of office space that it existed in the Twin Towers, be replicated along with the retail space that was there, even while providing much more open space than was there before. And this is obviously the source of a great deal of the design problem. Some people say that Larry Silverstein isn't capable of realizing this amount of office space, and if he did, he couldn't lease it. What do you think will get built, and what will happen?
It's an interesting question. First of all, in my proposal, I fought for something very hard, which was achieved, which is to remove some of the density off-site, to find another site so the site wouldn't be so compressed with office buildings and shadows. And I was lucky to be able to put one of the office towers. There are five office towers. The fifth one is south of Liberty Street, which is not exactly on Ground Zero, which relieves the density and makes it more open, because I'm concerned with light. I'm concerned that people have a human environment to work and to live. And I often, you know, my book is not just about Ground Zero, and I often thought about, you know, my parents, who were survivors. My father started in this country by hauling paper in a print shop on Stone Street, just around, and became a printer. And my mother worked in a sweatshop as a garment worker. But I thought, what does this site mean to New Yorkers like them? They'll never occupy the office towers. They'll never be in the boardrooms. They're not part of that. They'll be using the streets, the subways. What does this site mean to them? And that's what I was very concerned, to bring light to the underground, to make streets which are interesting, to make the memorial, which is a moving one, which means something to people and is not just you know, a little park. And I also thought, what can be built which will be complete in 4 years? And I didn't indulge in fantasy. I said to the governor and to the mayor that I'm interested for this not to be a building site for the next 15 years, because we don't know all the conditions, how long it will take, what will happen. No one can be a prophet. But I thought that in 4 years, one should accomplish a kind of finished project, which with the memorial, with the Freedom Tower, with the Wedge of Light Plaza, with the subways reconnected, the station, and the museums and performing arts centers. And I think that's on course. And I think in 4 years, you'll see those things. And it's not going to be dependent on continuing to build all the office towers as part of a kind of scheme. Of course, we all hope that business will come back and that these office towers will be built ultimately. But the project is certainly not dependent on doing that at once.
Mm-hmm. In Paul Goldberger's recent book, Up From Zero, which is a good companion to yours, he leaves the reader with the impression that the various competitions that led up to your selection as the master planner were too heavily focused on, as a beauty contest, what will the final buildings look like, and that more time should have been spent planning and finding ways to resolve some of the serious problems of Lower Manhattan, such as its difficult connections to the airport and other issues. What do you think of his analysis?
No, I completely disagree. I disagree with the notion that planning is some sort of abstract process devoid of its expression in buildings. I think when you see some of the housing blocks built in cities like Philadelphia, elsewhere, you see that disconnection, the idea that the world is some sort of abstract world where you can manipulate densities and figure out planning. Because, in fact, at the end, it's about space. It's about human space, lived space, the streets, the views, the kind of feeling and atmosphere that a city possesses. And I think that what happened in the competition, which started, of course, by the projects of the Lower Manhattan Development Corporation being rejected by New Yorkers. You'll remember that LMDC presented projects just like a normal agency. You know, here are the projects that we're going to rebuild, Ground Zero. And New Yorkers, in an unexpected, really heroic idea, rejected it. 5,000 people in the Javits Center said, we don't want this kind of thing anymore done for us by authorities. We want something that means something to us, something that is something which is part of our lives. And then LMDC had to. It was forced to hold an international competition, call for entries, hundreds of architects, you know, all sorts of things. So I believe it was a day and a process, democratic process, by the way, because it was very interactive. Millions of people participated in giving their opinions, discovering what the projects are, giving their opinions, what to do, what not to do, not just the families of the victims. I think this has changed the whole idea of planning, that it does belong to people, that it is not done for them, that architecture is a civic field. It's not a field for the private. By the way, the word idiot in Greek means a private person. So architecture is not for idiots.
That's very good. During that competition, when the final choice came down to you and to a group called Think that involved Raphael Vignoli and Frederick Schwartz and some other people. At one point, the New York Times architecture critic Herbert Muschamp lavishly praised your design, and then a couple weeks later, he turned on you. And I was wondering, and I'm sure a lot of people here are wondering, how much you think he undermined your plan.
Well, look, there will always be a critic. There will be always opinion. We are in a democracy, as I said. Everybody has a right to. But you have to also stick to what you believe in. And you can't just be swayed. You have to keep on a certain course, on a certain path, and not be derailed to the left and to the right. And, of course, there are also the forces. Some people think my plan is too flexible. It's too open to intervention. Others think it's too rigid and it's too architectural. So I feel that this criticism keeps me in line, keeps me kind of in the center. And, of course, critics in our society have a big voice, media have a big voice, but I think they underestimate that they are not the only voice. There are other voices, and just because we hear something in the news, just because we see it on TV, doesn't necessarily make it the most important thing. And again, I believe that, who knows what happened to this critic? What motives? I can assume what they were. But Ground Zero and architecture in general goes beyond that kind of just a small world of my buddies and a kind of a small political nexus of connections and who gets a commission. It's bigger than that, and that's what I'm about then.
But New York did turn out to be an incredible swamp of politics. It must have been quite an education.
There's nothing that can I can tell you. There's one thing that could prepare you for it, which prepared me for it, which is living in the Bronx. I grew up in the Bronx. And, when you grow up in the Bronx and you're not wealthy and you live in the neighborhoods, you get to appreciate New York. And it's a fantastic city. And, you don't just give up because somebody, gives you, punches you in the face or something. That's just part of being part of the city.
Yeah. You worked in Europe for many years. You built a Jewish museum in Berlin, and which was quite a struggle in itself. But architects are treated differently in Europe. Could you describe the differences, what you've observed between working in Europe and working in America?
Well, each place is unique. It's hard to make a generalized comment, but in my book, in Breaking Ground, I speak about my first building. As my wife, it's also a love story, by the way. My wife calls me a late bloomer because the Jewish Museum was my first building. I never built anything before, not even a small house, nothing. I never even planned any imaginary villa for fantasy because I thought, you'd be lucky to work with the public, with people. And of course, there are struggles, each building. And I've been fortunate to work, start my career. I call myself the architect of market economy because all my work started in the public realm. It was competitions in the public open space. Now I have some actual commissions from investors and others, so I'm lucky. But there's nothing greater than that public world. And of course, Europe, in Berlin, it was a struggle, tremendous struggle, to get this building, the Jewish Museum, built. Because it was not just about a building. It's how that building expresses not just the intellectual ideas of Jews in Germany and the Holocaust and the future of the city, but emotionally, how are people connected to the city? It was a tremendous battle. It took me 13 years to build a building. I say us, because my wife was my partner, and to a large extent, she's it for getting, and she's not an architect, by the way. But it took 13 years to build a building. And by the way, the irony of it is, after 13 years, the building opened its doors fully to the public, fully installed on September 11, 2001. It's such a strange coincidence. And it also closed its door because of the attacks. No one knew what. So again, I'm answering your question in a maybe oblique way. Each place is, I just won a competition for rebuilding the center of Milan, the historical center, some 64 acres, right very close to the Duomo. Each city has its own love for and its own history. And I think the good architects that I admire are not architects that just want projects, as many projects as possible, to build everywhere and to leave their stamp. Those architects don't interest me. What interests me is those architects who have a feeling for a place, who love a place, and are not just doing it because they want another job, but because they care. And I think that's true for almost every place that you are. Even in small, obscure little towns, people care about history. They care about what will be built, and it's as it should be.
You're nearing completion of an art museum in Denver. Can you talk about that? And that's been less fraught than some of your other projects, and it's taken less time.
Well, I've been very lucky to win the competition in Denver for the Denver Art Museum. It's an extension to the art museum, but it's more than that. It's also developing a whole new urban center. I'm designing housing. I'm designing the big garage has already been built, retail. It's a kind of a new cultural weight in the beautiful city. And I'm very lucky because the project is about the West, and it's about the Rockies, and it's about the optimism. And I'm very lucky. I've discovered so many things about Denver because it's a city where people are so positive, and the building is very bold. And I often say it is based on the Rockies because the Rockies are very bold. You know, the tectonic movements that gave rise to these often perilous vistas, vistas that are not always soothing but very powerful. And somehow that's the frontier. And I'm lucky that the building has resonated with even very wealthy tycoons who in the beginning when I started working on it said, Mr. Libeskind, are you going to build us a museum in marble with Greek columns? And, well, I tell you, it's not in marble and it's not with Greek columns, but I've had a tremendous fun and it's really lucky for this building to be constructed. And I think it's very bold, and I think it's already had tremendous input of the public. By the way, it's a civic process. It's a taxpayers' money, $62.5 million of taxpayers in Denver voted to build this building. So that's my client. I'm responsible to every member of the public, and it's fun.
Just one last question, and from what you learned at Ground Zero, how do you approach these projects differently now?
You know, Ground Zero is such an incredible, you know, it's a privilege to be involved in. It's also very humbling because you're working in the midst of all the forces, really, kind of microcosm of the world. It makes every single, I used to consider a complicated issue in life, look so easy. No, really, after working at Ground Zero, even tough projects seem to be just like balloons, just nothing, just flying a balloon in there, just fun, just, and it has taught me that building, and again, one has to be prepared for the marathon, and I guess my first project was the Jewish Museum, which took, as I say, 13 years. It wasn't easy. It was emotionally very, very tough. I didn't ever plan to live in Germany, but I'm glad I moved there. I was almost disowned by my family when I moved there, but I decided that's the only way to make something happen that is positive, that isn't just the cliches of the past. So what I've learned is that there is much more in life than we can ever learn in a book. And I've also learned that the true values are not the things that can be just discussed and appropriated, you know, by Republican Democrats or, you know, sort of, but that are lodged in every heart of every person in a free and open society, as this one is. And it's been an inspiring process. I've learned a lot.
Well, thank you. Thank you. So we're going to take some questions now. And I believe there are people here with microphones. And if you raise your hand, we'll call on you. The woman over there in the front. Here comes someone with a microphone.
Hello. I had a question for you. Basically, since you've designed a few buildings, exactly how do you go about designing these buildings on a creative level? Do you come up with a concept, or do you just go and try to solve the problem of the program? Or, you know, exactly how does it come across to you as far as how you're going to design this building?
It's a great question, and I'm not just trying to sell my book, but I do grapple. I do grapple with this question in the book because inspiration is, I don't start with a grid. I don't start with, you know, here is, of course you have to absorb the program. You have to understand what the client wants. You have to understand it. But you have to discover something that it's something wondrous, something that is not obvious. And I think each building has to be kind of inspired. You know, the Crystal building, which is a museum extension in Toronto, the largest museum in Canada for nature, was inspired by, I appeared in the collections of the museum. I saw a crystal. Just that, you know, it was in an exhibition. I suddenly saw the whole of Toronto and the intersection on the main street. In Denver, it was the Rocky Mountains and also the open eyes of people that were so affected by being so high up in the altitude, reflecting the sun even more than any eye that I've ever seen. You know, in every building, in Berlin, I based the building on things that were not visible completely. People who used to live there who are no longer there. It's certain traces and lines of connection that are not obvious and yet part of the history of that city. So I think every project requires a unique approach. I don't think there is kind of a formula that you can take out of a drawer and say, and that's what I also criticize in my book, the modernist architects who were so great but also so vicious in a way to impose an abstract idea. You know, a Mies van der Rohe building looks the same in Havana as in Chicago. It makes no difference where it's located.
Do we have more questions? Yes, woman in the back.
'9/11 basically changed the premises of civilization. How do you get up in the morning and look in the mirror and see yourself as worthy or able to take on that kind of a challenge?
Well, it's a very good question. My window of my home faces Ground Zero, and so does my office. I see it every day, in the morning, in the evening. And by the way, I come sometimes late out of the office in a cold night or a rainy night, and I see at 1 o'clock in the evening people standing around Ground Zero. Often many people in inclement weather. And I wonder what goes through their minds. But I think it goes through all our minds that site is about the world. And as I say, this day, you're right, 9/11 changed the world fundamentally. A bleak horizon has opened in front of us. We thought, you know, it would never open again. But then I think about it, this is not new. If you read the Bible, if you read all the great books of ancient wisdom, the world has always been under pressure. It's how people act under pressure that is important. And of course, by putting yourself into that pressure, by resisting the negative things, and by fighting for what you believe, I think you're part of the world. And it's not a new issue, you know. I often think that the Ten Commandments probably are easier to absorb than the Declaration of Human Rights of the UN, which runs about 50 pages.
Yes, the gentleman in the front, please.
Vice President Cheney has said that there will be another attack in the United States. It's not a question of whether, it's a question of when. This site was attacked in 93 and again in 01, and it would seem to be a logical target for bad guys. And yet the people involved, you and others, have the courage, and maybe it's more than courage, to move ahead with this enormous investment, this grand new project. Is there an implication that terrorism is overstated in your willingness to go forward?
No, I think we are aware of vulnerabilities. Cities are vulnerable. We are aware of it. But I have to say that when I created the Freedom Tower in its height, it was not myself alone. It was the entire New York, all New Yorkers at Javits Center, which represented a very wide public, said, we want to restore our skyline. We don't want a horizontal city. We are not going to be vanquished by these attacks. And we are New Yorkers. We believe in the city. And I think that's a spiritual state. It's not just about practicality, because no one has to build these towers. You know, we could build, but I think architecture does stand for something. It stands for something that is worth fighting for. And, of course, the world is full of evils, full of people who would wish us ill and would want to see fundamentalism and fascism take form. But I think architecture is a cultural answer. There might be political answers on the horizon or military answers that we see in the news. But architecture is a creative discipline. It's a civic response. And I think in that sense, it is a very important response. I believe in what I'm doing. I believe in all the New Yorkers who voted exactly with their opinions that they don't want a low-rise set of buildings, and that they want to have the memorial and tall buildings. By the way, that was a democratic decision. It was not only mine. And I think it's great. And, of course, cities are vulnerable. They have always been vulnerable in history. But we will prevail, because democracy will prevail.
Yes, in the back, on this side.
Well, I described this in a book. Originally, as the competitors, we were not allowed to be in touch with the families or with anyone, in fact. There was kind of embargo and everything. But we became very close friends with many family members subsequently, and we remain to this day. And, of course, when I started the project, that was at the core of my project. I started with that, those who perished on that site. The heroes of 9/11 is not just a rhetorical trope. It's about people. And that had to be the center of that site. And, you know, more than 6 acres of the 16-acre site is devoted to that memorial. I mean, it's not easy to regain the density and not to build on that area, because it is really a very special area. It has elements of sacrality to it, and it was simply part of the scheme in my notion that nothing should really be built there, no tall towers, and that space should be devoted to what subsequently became the competition for the memorial, and I think it will be very moving. So, but I did describe the very moving moments I had. I described one of them where two fathers, one whose son was a firefighter and one whose son died in one of the towers, came over to me just after I presented the project in the first presentation. And they said, Mr. Lipsky, I want to show you something. And they unrolled a piece of paper in front of me. And I didn't know what it was. It was a big piece of paper with what seemed to be thousands of little red dots. just the whole, and I had no idea. And they said, you know, Mr. Lipskin, this is where different body parts were found on the site. And, you know, I just, my mind exploded. It's not something you can conceive when you see it on a piece of paper. Each, you know, there are thousands of them, maybe tens of thousands of them. So I had very moving encounters. And by the way, the same two fathers came to me after I presented the tower and the final plan. And they said to me, you know, Mr. Libeskind, you delivered to us what you promised. You delivered the memorial. You delivered the bedrock and the slurry wall and the buildings that mean something to us. And you didn't disappoint us. So that is an ongoing relationship. And, of course, these families are very important to me.
Good lead into my question, that story. I had a historian talk about the oral histories she had collected of people who'd witnessed 9/11. One that I especially remember was a physicist who talked about how he perceived bodies falling. And he began to understand it suddenly in his panic, thinking of laws of acceleration and sort of understanding how high they were based on the speed at which they were moving. And it startled me just how the range of how people can see something. And this historian's question to the people that she spoke with was, how do you perceive this tragedy based on who you are now and also your prior experience with tragedy?
It's a very, very interesting question, I have to say. Mm-hmm. There are two projects which I did where I did not research anything in a library or archive. I didn't. One project with the Jewish Museum in Berlin, and one was Ground Zero. I didn't go to library and start looking for materials for two reasons. Both of those projects are connected because they're part of my own life. They're part of my own experience. In Berlin, as a child of Holocaust survivors, as someone whose immediate family was exterminated, and in Ground Zero, first of all, as someone whose father worked around the block. Second of all, as someone who went to school and saw the site being built. I used to go to the site with my friends, you know, almost every week. It was a huge world wonder and very controversial, the towers. And thirdly, as someone whose brother-in-law worked for the Port Authority as an engineer in those towers. I used to be a very frequent visitor to those towers. And it's not about abstraction. It's about an experience. It's about a human experience. And of course, you're right. You have to bring something to the experience which is more than just the knowledge of information. And that's what, by the way, architecture is. Architecture is not just a result of statistics. If it's good, it has an emotional impact. And it has to reverberate. And the buildings we love, whether it's our home or some corner of the world which we identify with, have that reverberation, and it's what connects us to the world. Well, often we think architecture very abstractly, but we would not have any world if we didn't have architecture, because it gives us the orientation to where we are, who we are, what is the window we are looking at. It's not just the mirror that you asked me about, looking in at myself in a mirror in the morning, but it's the window you open, and it's what you see out of the window, and it's determined by the shape of the window you have and what has been built on that horizon, which shapes you and gives you also a responsibility for it.
Yes, over here, please.
I happened to be in Berlin in October, and I went to the Jewish Museum. I also went to Sachsenhausen, and I also went to the offices of the Wehrmacht, where Count von Stauffenberg planned the attack on Adolf Hitler. It looked to me, I'm not an architect, it looked like a lightning strike. And it also looked like the slashes were the whip of God and man. But I'd like to hear you say some things about your vision for the Jewish Museum.
Again, I describe it in quite a detail because you're right. I never thought about it as a lightning bolt, but that's what Berliners called, you know, it was a public competition. But by the way, no one had any intention to build anything. You know, it was just an exercise of, you know, as most competitions, they're usually tickets to oblivion. Nothing really is achieved in a competition. You have to, you know, very rarely, you have to really struggle to get something meaningful. But when I presented that project, the Berliners immediately called it the Blitz, which means the lightning bolt in German. And I never actually saw it, but it is a kind of a shape that has very dramatic angles. And of course, those slashes, they're not really windows at all. They are almost, what I did is I started by projecting a certain topography, which you didn't see in the city anymore. Between Jews and Germans, which started with a kind of the emblematic Star of David, the six-pointed star, multiplied into thousands of relationships and imprinted, as if I folded this relationship of lines and directions into the facade or the building itself and cut through it with a very unexpected light, which is, of course, you're right. It's not just the light of what we can see. It's also the light that's penetrating the building that's connecting oblivion, in one hand, of people who are there but are still there, and a future of a city which is developing around them. So, of course, everything in that building, it wasn't just about making, of course, the exhibition spaces and all the necessary spaces, but I want to say that I believe that architecture is about communication. It's not about inert functions. It's like storytelling, like literature. I mean, this is a library, so we know. It's more about telling a story. If it's a bad piece of architecture, then it tells you a very simple-minded thing. How much it cost, who built it, and who commissioned it. That's it. That's the whole story. If it's a building that has some depth, it tells you something about history, about the city, about other things that you might not even have known. And tells you also something about the future of the city.
Do we have any more questions? Oh, yes. Over here. Woman.
What do you think of the new building at MoMA, of MoMA?
I also have it in my book. You know, I didn't make myself very popular, but, you know, everybody's, of course, it's a fantastic museum. Who could not find it an incredible building and, incredible? But I thought that the idea of making just a cool white box and being sort of proud of it kind of is not really in touch with the forces of the world. And I thought of, I have to tell you something. Because in that move, the logo of Museum of MoMA has taken over everything else. And I thought of, myself. I used to go to Museum of Modern Art. You know, I lived in the Bronx, like my friends in Brooklyn. We used to go there. It was cheap. It was kind of empty. It was very accessible. When you make a museum look like a, Gucci shop or a, Vuitton shop, you make a statement about the logo. And, I would have preferred, I love, the galleries are great and so on, but I think the public spaces could have used imagination, could have attracted kids still from the Bronx and Brooklyn and from what really makes New York to think that it's also just easy to go to this museum. You don't need to have all those other accoutrements. So, I like it, but I also have a critique of it.
Yes, question over here.
What's the most striking building you see in Philadelphia?
Oh, that's so hard to answer. There's so many. I mean, Philadelphia has... First of all, I love the historical buildings. When I came here first, I just went to Independence. So I did, as an immigrant, I wanted to see those places where, the founding fathers of this country... Because I was very impressed that a couple of men and women took on the biggest empire in history because of their love for liberty. And I think that's what, by the way, makes Philadelphia to me kind of the most unique city, beyond the words about it. It's how it was constructed, who was here. And you see it also in its modern buildings, in the Louis Kahn, in the laboratories, the Richards Laboratory. You can see a kind of connection to a greatness of a city. But there are so many, I can hardly pick one.
I saw some hands before. Yes, this woman in the first row.
You said that that it's going to be about 4 years to complete the project of the World Trade Center, but it took you 13 years to complete the museum in Berlin. And I understand that when thousands of people's lives were lost in New York City, there were millions more to take their place. In Berlin, of course, the Jews that are no longer there aren't millions to take their place. What prompted 13 years? Was it anti-Semitism? Was it politics? Was it difficulty? And how many Jews are there who would... how did that happen? And 13 years just sort of strikes me as very odd.
It's very odd. But, you have to think about it. That to build what became the Jewish Museum... By the way, the museum went through 5 different governments. There's a whole story in the book. 5 different governments of Berlin. Went through the unification of Berlin. I moved to Berlin in 1989 before the wall came down. It went through turmoils of... It went through, by the way, a unanimous vote of the Senate of Berlin to scrap the project. The political body that runs the state of Berlin and the city unanimously voted, we don't want this building. And probably if you had inquired the public at large, what are the chances for a building that has to do with Jewish culture, with the past, but also with the future, what are the chances for such a building to be built? Probably people said almost none, maybe 1%, maybe not even that. But you have to be a believer. My last chapter in the book is called Faith. You've got to be a believer. You have to believe in something because belief isn't just a footnote. Even if it doesn't make things happen, it's part of what is possible. And many things were unexpected in this building. The fact that this building was built is a testament to the fact that not only I alone and my wife were really originally very lonely. There was anti-Semitism, and there was not a will. And by the way, the museum changed its name many, many times because, well, I don't want to tell you the whole story, but it started as an Abteilung, a Jüdische Abteilung, a Jewish department, which is just a small department within an extension of the Berlin History Museum. And there were many international architects in this competition, many from Israel, many from other countries. All of them did the same thing. They made a kind of a synagogue-like little building, and then the rest of the thousands of square meters of the space was the extension of Berlin's history. I did something very different in my building. When I thought about it, I said, you know, Jews were not an ethnographic object, like, you know, the theater collection, the graphics, industrial history of the city. They were involved in the success, and they were part of the city. So you can't compartmentalize them. You can't just make a space which is closed. You have to bring all of Berlin across the void of its own absence to reach a hopeful future. Well, of course, gradually people began to understand this, but it was politics. It was, again, largely due to Nina, my wife and partner, who comes from a political background. And I thought when the building was canceled, I should just, you know, pack my bags. There's nothing more you can do against such a powerful political decision. But she understood that it's about people. You have to speak to people. Nothing is irreversible except death.
I think we have time for one more question. Sure. Some question that someone's been dying to ask. I think I saw a hand. We'll end with the same person who started.
Thank you. My name begins and ends with A, so that works. My question was about criticism and critics. Basically, have you advanced to a level where the critics and criticism doesn't bother you when it comes to your designs? Or, you know, does it affect you in some way, and how do you deal with that?
It's a great question. Look, as I said, it's a love story. I couldn't do it with loud love without having someone else who believes, who is there in dark times, who puts a smile on my face, and who herself has a kind of a view of what is happening. It would be difficult to do it on one's own. So I'm lucky to have a partner in life who shares an experience. But of course, there is always going to be criticism in an open society. And yet, I often point out that many people think democracy leads to mediocrity architecturally. They think, oh, it's democratic, it's going to be washed down, it's going to be compromised. I don't believe that. I think democracy, and we've seen that this is a country that is the longest lasting democracy in the history of its scale. I believe that precisely believing that it is not just one or two critics or one or two leaders of opinion who, of course you have to listen to criticism, but you have to also, as I said, pursue something that you think is worthy and something that belongs to reality and not only to a very small segment of it.
Thank you. Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you again. Thank you to Inga Safran and Daniel Lieberskin.
Thank you.
Please join us upstairs for the book signing. I would urge you to take a look at the book. It is one man's journey, but it is also a journey that includes all of us. So have a look at the book, and we'll see you upstairs.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.